Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, April 3rd, and Republicans by and large are still trying to wrap our head around what exactly happened in the special election on Tuesday and how we lost a conservative seat in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, yet Trump won that election by a fairly substantial margin in 2024, and also how in Florida, for at least one of the special election seats, we basically nominated possibly the worst candidate ever, and nobody really thought to say, you know, let's recontemplate this and maybe see if we can get somebody better to go up there. And as we're all discussing this, my good friend Steve Dace has a theory. He said this on The Blaze yesterday: the party brand is tarnished. Trump is clearly more popular than the Republican Party. When people can vote for what they believe without having to vote Republican, they do that. This is really interesting. And let's welcome in Steve Dace, who is a host at The Blaze of The Steve Dace Show. And Steve, I think this is coming back to the phenomenon of the big tent MAGA and how, yeah, a lot of people can vote Trump, and that's great, and the Trump mandate is because of that. But when we look at what Congress has actually done to codify any of Trump's wins or thoughts, they're doing nothing. When we look at a lot of these other special elections and gearing up toward the midterms, I'm not particularly persuaded that's going to be helpful to Trump's cause. And so the big tent MAGA votes for him, but what about the party itself? When you have such a big tent and people are failing to, the newcomers are failing to assimilate to conservatism and defend things like pro-life, traditional marriage, the family, where does this leave us? And good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. Well, I mean, yesterday in the Texas state legislature, they had a prayer for trans children. So I'm not really sure where this model of conservatism we've all talked to each other about for generations on shows like you and ours, I'm really not sure where in America, including now in your own home state, where your legislature is essentially trying to prove the proverb, the dog returns to its own vomit in real time. Like, I'm not sure where this proof of concept of who we are and what we think actually exists. We're still moving to the right in Iowa, but I don't know of a lot of other places where this is the case. And this gets us to the bifurcation that I talked about yesterday on The Blaze that you led off with here. What we are seeing, a massive cultural shift, and the kind of cultural shift that audiences like AFR's and ours at The Blaze would have been longing to see. I mean, for example, I think last year we had about a 30% increase in new Bible sales in America last year. You can look at what happened with Snow White, for example, just completely imploding as a property. And that's, you know, Disney had not had a flop since 1985. They've had five in the last 4 years. So, you know, you are people, the cultural shift we want to see, the pushback on the curriculum in schools, 80% of Americans are against men and women's sports. The pushback we wanted, the NBA when we were kids was you know, challenging the NFL as the most favorite sport in America, and now it's trying to hold off the NHL as the least favorite professional team sport in America. So we are seeing this cultural shift happen. I didn't know who Theo Von was at this time last year. I found out who Theo Von was when Donald Trump went on his show. Okay, he's from another America I don't typically follow or watch. And yet I watched an episode of his podcast on YouTube a couple of weeks ago where he had a guest on and was advocating for banning pornography. I mean, this could have been like a Don Wildman, you know, radio show from 1981, okay? So, I mean, we are seeing this cultural shift happen everywhere we want, except one place, politically. The Republican Party brand is tarnished. And this is not something more door knockers, and I say this respectfully to people I like that I call friends, but I saw this talk, we need more resources because our party demographic has shifted. It's more day laborer now. And I don't agree with that at all. Okay. For example, if I paid for 1 million door knockers to knock Des Moines, Iowa, where I live, and it was simply to push the message, we want you to abandon your iPhone and buy a 1975 style IBM mainframe computer. And if I put 1 million door knockers on the ground in Iowa, city or Des Moines, Iowa, city of about 500,000, and Apple spent no money at all, nothing to counter my message. Do you think that'd be a convincing investment, Jenna, if I did that? No.
Hopefully people would still think for themselves.
Yes. IBM's brand is tarnished. Apple's isn't. So the ROI, the amount of contact to conversion I'm going to get, that would just be a wasted expense. The GOP message that we want got out. Look at the vote for voter ID in Wisconsin. It received 63% of the vote. There were more than 120,000 people that voted for voter ID. That's our singular issue. There is no Democrat in America that is in favor of voter ID. Nowhere. So 120,000, more than 120,000 people in Wisconsin voted for voter ID, but then voted for the Democrat state Supreme Court justice. That's crazy. So that tells you that our message got out. The problem is the brand. You saw this in the Florida special election, the two of them. You won them both, but by way underwhelming margins. And what you saw in this last presidential election, Trump's evangelical turnout, overall turnout, not percentage, but turnout, was the lowest of his three presidential runs. He still received, 81%. But the overall percentage of the electorate that evangelicals were was down from 2020 and 2016. It was the MAHA group of Theo Vons, RFK Juniors, people that may not be as right wing as we are, but at least still believe in truth, justice, and the American way. They were the people that Trump put Trump over the top this time. On top of the fact that Trump before that. Reversed his public image by bypassing the media this time and doing all these long-form podcasts and reminding everyday Americans why he was one of the most popular celebrities in the world before he ran for president. And so our brand is tarnished. We saw this for the underperformance in 2022 of Republicans in that midterm, and only in states where there was strong leadership, Georgia, Florida, and Iowa, did you see Republicans be successful there. But even down ballot, Brian Kemp couldn't help Senate candidates in those elections, for example. You saw the off-year off-year elections, special elections. I was on your show all of last year warning we are getting destroyed in these special elections and off-year elections. Democrats are outperforming their demos by an average of 9 points in these races. It is very odd to lose the lead-up election cycle and then win the next election cycle. We did that. But also keep in mind, we did that coming out of this with the smallest House majority in over a century when one party had total control in Washington, D.C. This brand is tarnished. It doesn't win in swing states outside of what I would describe as a bifurcation, meaning that people can vote for what we think without having to vote for us. Trump is seen as the public as a bifurcation. They do not see him as a uniquely Republican vessel, right? So he's not a manifestation of the Republican Party to the public. He's a manifestation of the bifurcation. The Democrats have this exact same problem. People have turned on the uniparty. They want something different. And so what you're seeing right now is the Democrats have no message. They have no leadership on the horizon. The Republicans are struggling to unite on a message. The only thing that holds them in common is fealty to Trump for various reasons. Some of them, like Lindsey Graham's Craven, some of them, you know, like a lot of your audience and mine, you know, true beliefs that, you know, he has what it takes to turn America around, both some ratio of ideologically or, you know, with strength of persona. After that, like this tariff plan he's doing right now, I'm willing to give it a shot. I've been lied to by the same experts telling me this won't work for a generation. If it doesn't work, the MAGA brand moving forward is mortally wounded. People do not forget when you mess with their pocketbooks. On the other hand, if it does work, I mean, he's going to found a political dynasty that's going to long outlive him, you know, because the right now is still trying to figure out what is its message. And, you know, we told our audiences, you know, there was always going to be a price eventually. You know, do not be deceived. God will not be mocked. A man will always reap what he sows. We told our audiences that John McCain was conservative. We told our audiences that Mitt Romney was conservative. And I remember those years, and I alienated a lot of people. I made a lot of enemies pushing back on that messaging and that level of grift and glad-handing in order to get access, you know, play access-based politics. And the day would come when the silent majority generation would die off, and a new generation that got lied to all that at that time is not going to so easily buy into our talking points. Well, that day is now here. And this, the kind of conservative messaging and stuff that we all, that you and I grew up on, there is no real base for that outside of the innards of our own base. We've so diluted what we believe, all right, that at this point people are looking for red Caesars. They're not looking for some form of ideological catechism.
And I think you're absolutely right, Stephen. For those who haven't listened to your show in the last 2 days, why not? But also they need to, especially the one from April 1st. I think there was several segments of really exceptional analysis. I mean, per the usual, but maybe even more exceptional because of the time and the content. But I want to ask you another question, the same question that Jesse Kelly asked you that you mentioned on your show, but in a little bit different way, because or maybe with a little bit different target, because what Jesse Kelly asked along these lines is, OK, Trump has clearly the momentum and the loyalty behind him. That's why he won, you know, some of these districts by 30 points. And yet you're seeing razor thin margins for anyone else from the GOP. So why doesn't he spend political capital on raising up, you know, good people and endorsing good people, unlike going back and endorsing the Lindsey Grahams, potentially the John Cornyns, as Jesse said, that, you know, maybe in his home state of Texas, that'd be terrible. And, you know, and he tends to endorse the rhinos. But my question, kind of flowing off of that, is why isn't Trump then spending the political capital to actually redefine a brand that works and isn't so bifurcated, when you see his endorsements of the old Rhino GOP and these people who barely get through? Why isn't he raising up the next generation of MAGA that are, I mean, like J.D. Vance, I think, is the perfect example of a next generation that follows, that everybody loves, that's sort of lockstep in the Trump ideological framework. Why doesn't he go and find people like that in Florida and get behind people like Ron DeSantis, who's doing what Trump is doing, except on a more moral, biblically forward plane? But why continue this bifurcation by having the internal party politic nonsense and the old brand of the GOP? He needs to pave the way for the future. And it seems like he's completely not focused on that. Is it just because he's all about himself, or is there something deeper there?
Well, I would argue you would never have had Ron DeSantis as governor without Trump's endorsement. But the core of your question has merit, and it is one of the great mysteries on our side. You know, there are several different possibilities, some of them just as simple as he's just his worldview is not the same as ours in Trump's case. And so, you know, the core of Trump's worldview is art of the deal. And he's got priorities that he cares about, like, I mean, this tariff stuff. He, to his credit, he has talked about this stuff our entire lives. There are clips going back, Jenna, you and I's entire lifetimes of him talking about what he's saying right now. So it could be, hey, he thought to himself, and I remember I was at his very first ever event in Iowa the first time he ran in 2016. The first event he was at to in Iowa in 2015, this was all that he talked about. There was no talk of walls and immigration. He hadn't glommed onto those issues yet. So this is something that's very near and dear to his heart, something he clearly has a deep level of conviction on and was always planning on, if he got the chance again, to risk an inordinate amount of political capital on this, like Reagan did the same for supply-side economics and tax cuts spurring economic growth. So I think he's always had it in his mind he was going to spend a lot of his capital here. But I think your state and what happens in the next year between now and your gubernatorial primary is going to answer this question for us, or give us some of the answers, you know, because it's hard to psychologically analyze somebody, especially somebody as, you know, I'll say this. I had somebody that everyone in your audience would know, one of the bigger names in our industry. And he's very close to J.D. Vance. And I called him after watching Vance's rollout at the convention last year in a speech and just said, hey, that was very impressive. That would have probably never happened without you and your influence. So it looks like, you know, Trump has figured out how to, you know, pass on a legacy in the future. And he said something and he goes, thank you. But, you know, Trump is very complicated, he said to me. So I think that's one of the answers. One of the other answers is he's done this math and determined that it's a suicide mission. And what's happening with your governor and your legislature will answer that other half to us. Because if anybody could do what we've wanted, what you've described, it would be Ron DeSantis. It's a shorter, it's not as, there's only one political ecosystem he'd have to manage, his own, which he has dominated for the last 6 years. And he's got weapons at his disposal, like line item vetoes that Trump does not. He could found his own dynasty and get around term limits by having Casey run as a credible candidate, which I think they will. Okay. So he's got levers at his disposal to continue imposing his will on a do nothing legislature that wants to lame duck him that Trump does not have. And yet look what's going on in your state right now. And we have never seen a governor speak of his own legislature on the right in public, like what you're seeing from DeSantis right now. It'll be fascinating to see if it works. It is very clear that this legislature in your state wants to return to the Rick Scott era where Marco Rubio, but the Gang of Eight Marco Rubio was essentially a John Bircher in that Republican Party. They clearly are intent on going back to the grifting gravy train. And I have, you know, I've got friends who really like Byron Donald. This is not meant as a slam at him. It's very clear that they would prefer him as the nominee, if for no other reason. They know DeSantis will give them nothing. Maybe Byron Donalds will at least give him something every now and then. All right. So they are trying to tarnish the DeSantis brand. They're trying to take Nehemiah down from the wall and drag him into a debate over particulars and specifics that matter, but most people don't care about, in order to raise his negatives because his favorables are still very high, in order to make it more difficult for Casey to run to succeed him. You're watching your questions, proof of concept, being kind of tested right now in your own backyard. And we may get some, that may be some of our answers right there. Ultimately, if Donald Trump really wanted to, could he really push the Republican Party as a whole to go against its own grifting gravy train, its own corporatist gravy train? I don't know the answer to that. And it may not be yes, like we think it is.
And I think you're absolutely right that the parallels between Florida and what's happening on the national level are really spot on. And yet on the federal level, Trump has a lot more political capital even heading into the midterms, because right now he at least has that election in front of him, where DeSantis is beyond the last election in Florida, and they're trying to relegate him to the lame duck status. And this is why I think, by the way, Trump is saying clearly and doggedly that he is interested in a third term, and that he may. And I think the only reason he's saying that, not because that's impossible, it's not. We've seen that, yeah, that's part of history, that presidents have gotten more than two terms. Right now, procedurally, it's impossible. We could change that in a constitutional amendment form, but it's difficult. So practically speaking, I don't think that's going to happen over the next 4 years. But I think the reason that he is suggesting that he's very interested in a third term is simply to signal to all of the Republicans that he's not out of the fight yet and that he may still have another election left, because if he doesn't...
It's also why when he's asked, will you endorse J.D. Vance, he says no. Because if he starts really talking about who his successor is, the same psychology takes effect. You are correct about that. I would actually argue, if I were in the White House, I would actually argue to spend more of he's gonna have to fix one of the two branches, or his presidency's dead. I would actually argue, going back to our conversation of 2 weeks ago, you have to fix the courts first. Because even if you got the legislature to do whatever you wanted, some federal judge somewhere in the 666th district of your bowels will put up an injunction and universal injunction, you can't do this. Okay. Everybody they fire in D.C. gets an injunction. You have to reinstate them. Okay. I mean, my assistant, Todd, his wife worked at Voice of America. Okay. And so they understand that, you know, they're in favor of what's happening, but it's very weird because it also will cost her her job. And it did. And then a lawsuit, which she wasn't privy to and wasn't going to be a party to, reinstated her job. Okay. Which she was fine losing because she understood what Doge and Trump are trying to do. That's how convoluted this all is because of the courts. I would argue that even if we had a legislature that did what we wanted it, they would still have the same issue with all these unelected Democrat judges who act like they are their own perpetual onboarding constitutional convention. So to me, I would say the greater chance for generational political capital is to reset the judicial branch than the legislative branch. That's the argument I would make, but I'm open to the other side of that argument too.
Yeah, and I think you're right that if the judiciary was fixed, at least then he could get through some executive orders, and then it would be all eyes would be on Congress. And while the Republicans have the majority, then you would be saying, why are you talking about proxy voting instead of actually the SAVE Act? And more people would genuinely be upset about that instead of all of these nonsensical fights. I mean, just like the Florida legislature. I mean, they're talking
about... That's a great
point.
I want to make sure your audience understands how great of a point you just made, which is if we remove the canard of judicial supremacy, the amount of pressure that would be put on these Congress people, because there's no excuses for not doing their jobs. They can't Pontius Pilate this thing anymore and say, the courts have spoken, the mob has spoken. Everyone now knows the responsibility rests on them. And right now, they get to defer that to some degree publicly. That's a great point you made.
Yeah, well, thank you. Occasionally, you know, like you occasionally have brilliant analysis more often than I have great points. But, you know, we that's why we like to have you. But it would force the Republicans to actually focus on things, just like what Ron DeSantis is doing in Florida by calling out the legislature and saying, look, this is what the Florida mandate is, just like the Trump mandate on the federal level. The Florida mandate for all of the residents and voters in Florida is to actually reduce taxes, you know, get things done, push the conservative agenda so that we are the free state of Florida and the whole blueprint. And yet the Florida legislature is sitting here talking about carbon sequestration and arguing over parking lot spaces. I mean, literally nothing that anyone elected them to do.
Because they want to make Ron DeSantis argue about those things, so he's as hated as much as they are. And so Casey can't be the GOP gubernatorial nominee, so they don't have to tolerate another 8 years of principled leadership. That's what this is all about. Sam Ballard and Tobia, they know people hate them. They're well aware of this. They want to make the people hate Nehemiah too. And you can't, and that's the challenge. You have to, on one hand, you have to confront them. On the other hand, you cannot come down from the wall so that you give up doing the work that the people actually are in favor of and support you for. And that is the tightrope that Ron DeSantis is trying to walk right now. And it'll be fascinating to see if he's able to successfully navigate it.
Yeah, and this is all about the legacy in Florida. I mean, here, that's all anybody is talking about is, will we have a leader as strong as DeSantis when he is term limited? And is that a Byron Donalds? Is that a Casey DeSantis? Is that, I mean, what are we going to do when Ron DeSantis is out of office? And so the last question I have for you, Steve, and then we'll have to go to break, is what is Trump viewing when he's not going after his own legislature with the verve that Governor DeSantis is, and yet he is even more focused on his own legacy? I know DeSantis cares about the future of Florida and the principle. Trump is definitely concerned about the brand But where then is Trump in all this with saying, okay, as soon as the midterms are over, like it or not, as much as he's saying third term, everybody is going to focus on the 2028 presidential election. That's just how politics work. And you know that, and I know that. And so where is he at with ensuring that the weak and feckless GOP and the Congress isn't going to try to hamstring this and basically undercut him as soon as the midterms are over, like what they're trying to do in Florida with Ron DeSantis? Because I think that the Lindsey Grahams of the party and all of the other ridiculous rhinos in Congress are going to do that to Trump absent some other strategy.
Great question. I think Trump learned from the first term that nothing good happened unless he did it himself directly. And so I think his plan was to come into this term with way more of an infrastructure and a vision to do that from day one. And you saw that with the barrage of executive orders hitting them on the hitting the left on every conceivable issue we've ever wanted to fight on. You saw that on the way stronger appointments and department heads of these various agencies that are going to manage the Leviathan. I mean, go back and tell ourselves, I just go back and think to myself, Jen, as I'm, you know, helping to lead that fight against the scandemic, that I was going to see in a few years Jay Bhattacharya, Marty McCary, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. leading the three most important agencies in terms of healthcare policy in America. It would have blown my mind, and yet here we are. Okay, and so I think his plan has always been to lay the groundwork by doing as much unilaterally as he can to get as much of the support of the American people for that vision and plan as he can before we come to this juxtaposition we're articulating right now, where sooner or later you have to pick one of these branches and confront them head on, okay? And I think their plan is to roll the tariff thing out before they do that in the hopes that he's right and that we'll have a Reagan-like economic turnaround where in 81 and 82, Reagan was not popular. The economy had not yet rebounded from Carter. In 83, it rebounded mightily. And in 84, he wins a historic reelection. And so I think they are planning the tariff thing to do as a paradigm reset what Reagan's tax cuts did in the early 80s. And then when you have that at your back, you fix the economy, it's back roaring again. Now you've got the people behind you. And then you pick one of these branches and you're going to have to go to war with them. I think this is their plan because it's the only one that makes sense for how they are, for how they're so detailed in some areas and vague in others. So that I don't believe they just didn't think of these things because they thought of quite a few things. So I think this is a multi-year rollout here. The hope is that the economy rebounds strong enough by next year's midterms that they don't lose 40 House seats. And that's the gamble being taken with the tariff plan right now.
All the eggs in the tariff basket. And I think that is spot on analysis, Steve Dace. And we have to go to break here. I could hold you for the rest of the hour. Absolutely. But coming up, we're going to be talking to another red state governor, Governor Tate Reeves of Mississippi. But this I think, is a turning point and a pivotal moment in America to see, will we have the same momentum of the Trump loyalty and the Trump mandate that can carry on when he himself is not the candidate? And these two special elections, I think, are a really strong indicator that we need to take all of this very, very seriously as conservatives if we want to continue the momentum and not just go all the way back to having, you know, states like Florida be purple, for example. So we'll be right back with more right after this here on American Family Radio. Jenna Ellis is more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Let's welcome in Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who has signed legislation phasing out individual income tax. This will be the Build Up Mississippi Act, a legislation that phases out individual income tax in Mississippi. The bill cuts the individual income tax rate by 3% by 2030, with a future annual decrease until the rate falls to zero and the tax is eliminated. So good morning, Governor, and tell us more about this phase out.
Well, good morning, Jenna. Thank you so much for having me on today. This is a major legislative accomplishment for the state of Mississippi. In my State of the State this past January. I called on my friends in the Mississippi legislature to have this be the year that we got the ball across the finish line, and I'm happy to report that working together, we did exactly that. The House of Representatives made elimination of the income tax their number one priority. The bill that I signed, the Build Up Mississippi Act, was actually House Bill 1. It was the first bill that they passed in the legislative session, and we worked very hard to drive consensus amongst conservatives in both chambers, and we were successful in getting that done. And now we're on a path for Mississippi to become the 10th state in the United States to have no income tax, and the way we like to say it is the 10th state to have no tax on work.
And, you know, this seems to be a focus for a lot of conservatives, especially with the Trump mandate and how he's focused on reducing or even eliminating the federal income tax, which I would be a huge fan of. And so as a resident of Florida as well, having moved from a state that did have income tax in Colorado now to Florida, I mean, it's just such a relief for taxpayers. And so this bill also decreased sales on groceries from 7% to 5%. Effective July 1st. That's a great thing. But gasoline taxes reportedly are increased through tax year 2027. So how does this bill perhaps provide any offset to Mississippians while they're waiting for the decrease on income tax, but the gasoline tax is going up in the short term?
Right. So the gasoline tax will go up by 3 cents per gallon over a three-year period. Once that is fully implemented, which would be at the end of 2027, that would be a net increase in revenue to the Mississippi Department of Transportation of approximately $220 million. The reduction in the sales tax on groceries from 7 to 5% will go in immediately, so in 2025, and that's going to be an approximate similar savings of a couple $100 million per year, which goes in effect immediately. So the way I look at it, I didn't champion the increase in the gas tax, and that's not my favorite part of the bill. But if you look at those two provisions, the decrease in the sales tax on groceries, the increase in the revenue in the tax on fuel, they basically offset one another. And the over the next 10 to 15 years elimination of the income tax is about a $2 billion total tax cut. And so the net effect to working people across Mississippi is going to be a $2 billion reduction in taxes over time. And there is no year in the entirety of the phase-in that someone would actually have to pay more in taxes.
That's really important, I think, because, you know, some of the response that I've even seen on social media and in some articles as I was reading this was that some people were concerned that overall in that overlap they would be paying more. So this clarifies that, and I'm grateful for that explanation. And in terms of income tax specifically, when there's a difference between 1099s versus W-2s, and you know, the basically the tax on self-employment. That's something that, you know, somebody who, you know, I've been self-employed for years previous, and that always didn't make sense to me as well. What provision, if any, does this bill contemplate for those distinctions?
Well, we should incentivize individuals to be self-employed. We should incentivize more individuals to be entrepreneurs, because we want to create incentives so that individuals can better take care of themselves and take care of their families. Because as a conservative, I believe that government doesn't have anything that it doesn't first take from somebody else. And the reality is that we have an opportunity to make every Mississippian in the entire state of Mississippi pay less to the government and therefore be able to keep more. Again, that's a fundamental principle that I believe in. Government ought to take less so you can keep more. And whether it's self-employment taxes or any other taxes, that should be our mindset.
Yeah, and that really seems to make sense. And I'm speaking with Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who just signed the Build Up Mississippi Act. And there's also a lot about economic development and education in Mississippi. And so in terms of economic development, you know, since you took office, Mississippi has announced over $32 billion in new private sector investment. There's been a lot that you have championed. And speaking of encouraging people and incentivizing them to work and be entrepreneurs. This seems to go hand in hand with that philosophy.
It does indeed, Jenna. It's really been an unbelievable time to be in Mississippi. I often start all of my speeches with, it's a great day to be an American, it's a great day to be a Mississippian, but right now Mississippi has tremendous momentum economically. We have seen more capital investment flow into our state over the last 5 years than at any time in our state's history. And we're actually seeing the fruits of that labor, as in 2024, Mississippi, of all states, Mississippi had the second fastest growing economy in the entire United States. And Mississippi was number one in the nation in real personal income growth of all 50 states. And so I think that'll probably surprise some of your listeners, but that's where we find ourselves today. What's happening here is special, and I'm extremely proud of it. And we're going to keep working to build that. And the bottom line, when all is said and done, it's really pretty simple, and that is conservative policies work. They work for businesses, they work for individuals, they work for entrepreneurs, and they work for everyday workers who get up and put on their boots and go work to provide for themselves and their families. Conservative policies work regardless of how you voted in the last election.
And I think we're seeing maybe finally the American people overall and writ large waking up to that conservative policies work. And this is why the Trump mandate has been so effective nationwide. But we're seeing, you know, that the Democrats, the leftists, are pushing back against that. And so how is Mississippi overall championing these conservative ideas more broadly and using this as a plan to maybe help and incentivize other red states to follow some of these things that you're doing in Mississippi?
Well, there's no doubt that the election of President Trump has certainly motivated the far left. They Trump derangement syndrome is real. There is no doubt that that they are motivated and they're doing crazy things. But the fact of the matter is, that's not new. that's the new normal in the Democrat Party in America. They are far leftists, they are radicals, and the vast majority of those in the middle just simply do not agree with the policies that they are trying to enact. For example, men are men and women are women. That's not a very difficult concept for the vast majority of Mississippians or the vast majority of Americans. But for those on the far left that are running the National Democrat Party, it seems to be an extremely complicated concept to them. In Mississippi, we both chambers of our legislature yesterday passed anti-DEI bills, following up on President Trump's initiatives in Washington. I hope to get those bills to my desk within the next week or so that I can sign them into law, because we believe that everybody in America deserves and has an opportunity for success, and we want to give everyone an equal opportunity to garner that success.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense, that the American dream is predicated on merit and that it's not diversity, equity, and inclusion based. And my understanding from this ban is that the House version would ban DEI in all public schools from kindergarten through college. The Senate's a little different. So, you know, where they ultimately land in getting that to your desk hopefully will be as robust conservatively as possible. But speaking of education, just the last subject matter I want to get in to with you, Governor Reeves. Mississippi, during your time as governor, has also seen record-breaking academic success. And in fact, it's been so profound that the New York Times, of all the fake newspapers, referred to it as the Mississippi miracle. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, Jenna, I have joked that when I read in the New York Times about the Mississippi miracle, I almost choked on my catfish, that the New York Times, of all publications, actually said something positive about our state. But the reality is the numbers are so impressive and so so important that it, really no one can deny what's happened here. We passed conservative educational reforms in Mississippi in 2012 and 2013, and the results have been incredible. If you look, for instance, at fourth grade reading, in 2013, Mississippi was ranked 49th in the nation. Last year, we were ranked number 9 in the nation in fourth grade reading results. In fourth grade math, we were ranked 50th in the nation. Last year, we were ranked 16th in the nation. Our high school graduation rate has gone up from 72.5% to almost 90% of our kids are graduating high school today. If you look at the statistics, the state of Mississippi has the smartest fourth graders in the entire southeastern United States. The reason that's important is because if you have the smartest fourth graders today, in 10 years, you're going to have the smartest workforce in the entire southeastern United States. And that's why companies are moving to our state. That's why jobs are being created in our state. That's why per capita incomes are growing in our state. And one final point I'd like to make, because I think it's important. There are those on the other side of the aisle that believe that conservative policies only work for some people in some of our districts. But if you look at African-American students in Mississippi and you compare them to their peers all across the country, our conservative reforms have led to massive growth and massive improvement of our black fourth graders. Consider this. In 2013, our black fourth graders, when compared to their peers, were 45th best in America. Last year, they were third best in America in fourth grade reading results. Conservative reforms work, and they work for all kids that need and want an opportunity for success.
Well, thank you so much, Governor Tate Reeves of Mississippi, for your leadership, for emphasizing conservative policies, and for explaining to us what is working in Mississippi. I know that the American Family Association, we're based out of Tupelo, Mississippi, so even as a Floridian, I get over there quite a bit and love visiting your state, that we're grateful for your leadership on conservative priorities. So our AFR family is praying for you, and we thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jenna. Y'all have a great day, and God bless.
God bless. Thank you, sir. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network Clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we will be staying in Mississippi politics for the rest of the show because we'll be talking about the possibility of legalizing marijuana without any sort of medical permission or license. And, you know, these types of bills are cropping up, particularly in red states. And I personally think the reason is that my former home state, Colorado, showed how quickly you can turn from a pretty solidly red state that's maybe tinging on the verge of being purple to now a pretty solidly blue state, maybe if we're lucky, trending purple. And I think this is because of Amendment 64, which was Colorado's legalization of marijuana amendment back in 2012. And so the left seems to be targeting states, and I think it's simply for the purpose of attempting to undermine a lot of the traditional values in states and it's really overall not good policy. So Senator Angela Hill joins us now to talk about HB 1502, which I understand, Senator, it was actually killed yesterday. But tell us more about this bill and the status.
Well, basically, the bill was put forth in front of the legislature to legalize intoxicating hemp beverages. But it was, they tried to pass it on the guise of getting the other edible intoxicating hemp products out of the convenience stores. Legislators were basically told, if you will pass this intoxicating hemp beverage and make it law, then we'll get all the rest of this stuff out of the convenience stores and quick stops. But legislators were 100% being lied to and 100% being manipulated, because those intoxicating hemp products are already illegal in the gas stations and grocery stores and quick stops. They're already illegal under Mississippi law. But unfortunately, legislators have a bad problem not doing their homework and not knowing what existing law already is. So, you know, it was looked at as a trade-off. Well, we'll get all this stuff out of here if you'll just legalize this intoxicating hemp beverage, you know, that's going to be in the beer section of the grocery stores. And so there's a handful of us that actually do research and know the law. And fortunately, we were able to go to the podium, explain to the rest of the body of the Senate, you know, what the law actually is now, and that we're being lied to. And if you vote for this, you're voting a backdoor way to legalize recreational THC in Mississippi. And I don't know any Republicans other than one who ran for office on legalizing recreational THC, and they came in last in their own county. So it was an uphill battle, and we've been battling this for about 3 years, and it just came down to the wire the other day. And you know, I walked to the podium, a couple of other senators spoke, and, you know, senators that people know are not going to lie to them, fortunately. And so we were able to defeat the bill, I think, by one vote. So, you know, we kind of dodged a bullet again. But it's big marijuana that's pushing this. It's the same exact people that pushed the ballot initiative in Mississippi on recreational on medical, what they called medical, but it was actually recreational. And we were able to get that defeated through the Supreme Court. But it's the same exact people that were trying to get marijuana into the Constitution in Mississippi that are pushing this, quote, intoxicating hemp beverage. So that's where we are. Fortunately, it's dead for now.
Wow. And for now being the operative words. So thank you for your work on this, because we saw that over the battle here in my home state of Florida with Big Weed and the corporations coming in wanting to try to legalize this. And they sell it in a way to voters. Ours was a ballot initiative, so they were trying to sell it to the voters falsely. And thankfully, with our governor's help, we successfully defeated that for now. But it's the same thing that's going on in Mississippi. It's the same thing that's going on across the state. So in just the last minute or so we have with you, Senator Angela Hill, and thank you for your work on this. What do you anticipate arising? I mean, it just seems like the big weed corporations are intent on pushing these, especially in red states. I see them targeting, you know, red states specifically.
Yeah, they're not going to stop. And the same people that were pushing this hemp bill, this intoxicating hemp backdoor recreational marijuana bill, are the same lobbyists that pushed the Initiative 65 ballot initiative to try to get medical, quote medical, but it really wasn't medical, into the Constitution. So their other big fight is they want to get the ballot initiative reinstated in Mississippi, which was struck down by the state Supreme Court. So we know why these people want the ballot initiative back in Mississippi, because they want another attempt to get marijuana into the Constitution. They want to be protected more than any other industry. They want their constitutional protection so that nobody can touch the marijuana industry. And they, you know, they've sold it to people as, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to help cancer patients. This is going to help veterans. All we want is medical. We just want medical. Well, they got medical through the legislature.
And now they want it more. Well, thank you so much for your work. Cool. We've got to end here, but I really appreciate your time and your focus on this. If you're in Mississippi, if you're in a red state, make sure that you know when these ballot initiatives are coming up so that you can vote against them and don't let the big weed take over. So as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.